Hello and welcome to the Dahlgren Centennial Celebration, a century of innovation. We hope this and our many other products, events, and offerings will showcase what Dahlgren has accomplished during its last 100 years. Throughout our history, we have interviewed some of the most prominent minds, leaders, and innovators that have been here, and we're opening up the vault to share them with you this year. Today, we are honored to listen to the story of Harold M. Goldman, Jr., a lifelong resident of the Dahlgren area. Mr. Goldman served as the legal advisor for the base from 1949 until his retirement in 1965. Let's listen to Mr. Goldman.
Can you relate your first encounter with Dahlgren and give some of the circumstances surrounding that event?
You see, I grew up here. My father was a civilian personnel director. And he came here in 1919, and I've been living on the station ever since then. Now, the way we got here was by motorboat from Potomac Beach, including furniture and everything, and came up here to this boat dock, which is now the station dock. I don't remember how the furniture was carried from the boat to the Ibis, but that was my first contact with the station.
Were you born here?
No, I was born at Potomac Beach.
And when was your first contact with working here?
My first contact working here was as a Navy personnel officer in 1945 while on active duty with the Navy. But that was as a military officer as opposed to a civilian.
When did you come here in a civilian capacity?
I came here in civilian capacity in March 1st of 1949.
What did you do in between those years?
Between 45 and 49? Well, I went into the Navy in 42. I was called on active duty in January of 42. And I stayed in the Navy until January of 47. And after I was released from active duty in January 17, 1947. I was appointed then what they call trial justice of King George County on March 1st, 1947. And I stayed there until March 1st, 1949, which time I came here.
Well, we'd like to get your viewpoints on the Dahlgren scene and its relations with the local and Northern Neck communities during your career.
Well, of course, as you well realize, I'm a native and I grew up on the station. And there's been a tremendous change, not only here, but everywhere. But particularly here, when I grew up on the station, things certainly weren't as they are today, insofar as the residential community life is concerned. We did have a golf course and we did have tennis courts, but that was just about it. Had a ball down, baseball. Of course, it didn't play softball then. We didn't have any highways. 206 wasn't built until 1932. 301 wasn't built until 1940, I believe it was, when the Potomac River Bridge was constructed. And of course, 301 had to be constructed in Virginia to provide the Virginia access and egress Maryland and from Maryland. So the only route that we had in and out of here was through what today is still known as 614, which takes you up to B-Gate and across 301 and comes on out at Owens, and then snakes back and forth across present 206. And the exit to Route 3 is approximately the same point where it was as 614. And just beyond St. Paul's Church, we had Peppermill Stream, and that was the bugaboo of travel, and particularly in the winter months, because it was impossible to get up or down when weather was bad. And as an aside, it was always interesting to, I recall the tales of my parents and others who were able to find an automobile that would go up Peppermill Hill in high. Of course, we don't even, it's very difficult to envision that today, but that was quite an accomplishment then. Also, it was quite an accomplishment to be able to travel from Dahlgren to Fredericksburg in less than an hour's time, which was a ride indeed, because the roads weren't even paved.
Did you go up through 218?
No. No, that was next to impossible then. It was the old mail road, 218 was. But was not used for travel from here to Fredericksburg. Matter of fact, people were afraid to use it because of the terrible conditions in which it was to travel. But Dahlgren was isolated. And make no mistake about that, when it was established, it was an isolated community, which I think hurt it in the long run, because that tag of isolationism hung on. And this station always used it as a means of acquiring this, that, and the other under the context that we were an isolated community and an isolated activity. The station grew itself internally, but the community surrounding it did not. For the very simple reason, we were the Naval Proving Ground. The Naval Proving Ground, see, was a blue-collar station. And with the emphasis on blue-collar work and employment, private capital took the position that since it was government, it's here today and gone tomorrow. And that if it were gone tomorrow, that there was nothing left to support any investment. In other words, if Dahlgren ceased to exist, what would remain to continue the business that might be established off the station? And the answer was obvious. So this station itself had to get into the business of developing a community, which included not only the housing, but all the supporting facilities. Medical, schools, recreation, you name it, everything had to be provided here internally by the government. And that held the development of this area back. But it was a type of thing that the government had to do, not because it wanted to, but if it were going to continue to exist, it had to have these facilities. And the inducement of labor, I mean, of private capital coming in to invest was just out of the question. You couldn't do it.
What was the initial reaction from local citizens regarding the build-up of this ordnance facility in the area?
Quite negative, and particularly during World War II. You see, King George County is a rural county. It still is. But it was dominantly rural back in 1918. In addition, there was no other industry other than farming. There was no means of livelihood in the county other than farming. And also bear in mind that in the early 1920s, the automobile industry is just beginning to emerge. And so far as ownership of cars were concerned then, not too many people owned them because it simply didn't have the wherewithal to buy them. Jobs were just weren't available because there was nothing that produced the jobs. Now, when Dahlgren comes, it provides a steady payroll. And as a blue-collar station, where did that payroll go? It went to local people, because they were the ones who were coming in here as employees. And they didn't have to rely on outsiders. And see, it wasn't until the shift on outside employees came until we got into research. Therefore, we had to have professional and technical people who simply were not available locally. Now, that interrupted a pattern of life that King George had enjoyed for decades, I suppose, really, from its very beginning. And that was resented because local personnel found that hard hands and that local help were becoming scarcer and scarcer. And they resented the loss of that labor force. And they also resented the fact that they got a substantial wage, as wages went in those days, which was a steady payroll. They resented the fact that there started the build-up of homes in the county. And I can remember time and time again riding through the county with different people, and Dahlgren built that, Dahlgren built that. Well, of course, what they're referring to was the payroll and the people who were able then to become homeowners in their own right. So it was then when World War II came, of course, this labor force here expanded tremendously. And that really broke the bubble. Then there was simply no local help available in King George County, basically, and it never returned after the war. Then, of course, things did take on a radical change. Now, Tom Hunter, who was a local lawyer, was also the Cavalier. You know, he wrote this column in the Richmond Times-Dispatch, as it appears to the Cavalier, which was a daily column. And Tom Hunter, during World War II, had a special column on Dahlgren, in which he said the conditions were so intolerable down here that every time a new employee came through the main gate, one had to jump off the bridge into the creek and make room for him. He was outspoken, an outspoken critic of Dahlgren from that standpoint. But it's much like the story of Gone with the Wind after the Civil War. And this is typifies what transformation took place in King George County. Another example is St. Paul's Church. St. Paul's Church is an Episcopal church. And I'm not saying this critically, but it is a fact of life that the Episcopal Church in its old days was known typically as a family church. And this was quite true with respect to St. Paul's. There were old families, generation after generation, in this area of King George County, who were members of St. Paul's Church. And that's all the membership they ever had. And it wasn't until the 1930s, when Dahlgren, you know, became fairly settled, and then during World War II, that new blood was fused into St. Paul's Church, and the whole atmosphere and the membership of the church changed. And then the church started showing some progress because it was getting new money and in considerable amounts. And today it is doing quite well. As an Episcopal church, we never were noted for being rich churches.
This laboratory did have a big economic impact on the county.
Well, there's no question about that. And still does. And the same situation is true. If this laboratory were pulled out and no other industry took over, then King George County would be a blighted area. It would have no economy. This is the economy. But the amazing thing is that it has become the economy, and has been for years, not only of King George County, but surrounding areas. Konya Beach has always been a center of population for the station. Now, admittedly, that was primarily in the blue-collar rates during the 20s and the 30s. But we've had a number of professional employees who have sort of migrated down to Colonial Beach in the past two decades and become permanent residents. And the Colonial Beach employees, because of the inadequate highway travel, commuted daily by boat that was operated by an old boat captain named Captain Bruce. He was a resident of Colonial Beach. He had a son who worked here and lived here on the station. But Captain Bruce used to run that boat back and forth every day, summer and winter, and brought a considerable number of employees up.
How long did it take to get up here by boat?
I don't know. I know that my father used to come by boat when he was living at Potomac Beach before we moved up here. And obviously I don't remember this, but I remember his telling about it on one day when the Potomac River was frozen in the winter months, that he had gotten halfway here when he heard the whistle blow for noon. And so he decided he was just wasting his time. He was just breaking ice trying to get up. And so he gave up and turned around and went on back.
Then he got home at the usual time.
I think it was in the neighborhood of a half hour, 45 minutes, depending on weather conditions. So it didn't take any longer than it does today. Well, of course, it takes a little longer than it does today by reason of the improved highways.
You've been in the mainstream of legal action surrounding Dahlgren for a number of years. Can you give us a general perspective of the types of problems you encountered, the political personalities involved, and perhaps some of the unique situations you've witnessed? Okay, what about the types of problems you've encountered?
The station never had, as such, a legal officer until I was appointed as a civilian. Now, when I was here as a military personnel officer during World War II, I also had the collateral duties of being a legal assistance officer, but that was strictly for military personnel and had no impact on the civilian population. Now, I came in here when Admiral Joy was the commanding officer, and he was the first flag officer that we had as commanding officer, and he was followed by Admiral Kitson, Admiral Duke, and then Duke was succeeded by Captain Baring. We've never had flag rank since. So those three represent the only three flag ranks that we had as commanding officers. From my own personal standpoint, and injecting that officially, tried to operate on the basis that this station was a part of the community. And I never looked for any laws or regulations which we could use as a means of saying it doesn't apply to us because we are federal, but ways and means by which the federal government could make itself a part of the community by complying as far as practicable with the laws and philosophies and policies of the state of Virginia, and more particularly the county of King George. Now, as I mentioned before, and this is certainly true, there was a decided cleavage between the people of King George County and this station. Nothing in this world but an outgrowth of jealousy. That's all in the world it was. And it was not until we got the merger of the schools, wherein the students on this, the dependents on this station, were going to King George High School. And that takes a good full generation to accomplish, that we found a lessening of that feeling. And it's bound to, because the kids see it in a different light, and they grow up together as associated in the school system. And then they become the future residents. And it was through that transformation that we saw the lessening of that feeling. You still see some evidences of it here and there. But I was personally acquainted with it. I grew up in it. And my idea, as I said, was to try to make ourselves a part of the working community, as opposed to setting ourselves aside and saying, we are the United States government, we'll do it our way and you do it your way. Now, whether it's been successful or not, I don't know. But that has certainly been the principle under which I tried to operate, and I tried to extend it not only to the county level, but also the state level, by maintaining close contact with all of our state agencies and working with them and asking for their assistance on matters that of mutual interest that would arise. And I feel, I always have felt, that if all of our federal activities could and would operate with that philosophy, that we would have less feeling of separateness between the state and federal governments. Mm-hmm. But they don't do that. One of the major reasons why I feel that we were able to do this is because we are basically a civilian station. Therefore, we are not typical. And not being typical, we are, I suppose, operated in a non-typical manner. But the typical military activity is dominated by military personnel. And military personnel, again, we get back to that here today and gone tomorrow philosophy. And they don't care. It's not their problem. They're just here to execute their military assignments. Therefore, there is no relationship ever established between the military and the surrounding community. And that's understandable. But I do not agree that it must be that way.
You mentioned the military students going to King George High School.
Mm-hmm. And civilians.
Who were the ones that objected to this, mostly? What personalities were it? Like the school board, or?
There was no objections to the merger of the school systems as such. Mm-hmm. You have to go back to 1920, and I think that was about the date that the first school was established here on the station. Now, at that time, we were the Naval Proving Ground under the management authority of the Navy Bureau of Ordnance. I'm sure your other people have elaborate more on that. And Buord made funds available to this command for the operation of a school, elementary and high. And you're sitting right now where the first school was conducted, in this building. One half of this building was devoted for school purposes, and the other half for medical, strange as it may seem. And we provided education for grades 1 through high school. Then in 1922, the first Dahlgren school building was opened, and that is today what is known as the library and the chapel annex. And it was during World War II that the brick elementary school building that we have today was constructed. And it was also during that same period of time that the present dispensary was constructed. Now, the funding for the school continued through Buord. But as we approached the 40s, our high school population became too large on this station and too costly. In other words, we didn't have the facility to take care of the numbers, and it was costly to try to operate for the limited numbers. And so they made an arrangement whereby the high school was closed and the dependents or the high school students went to King George County. Then in 1951, Congress passed a special bill known as a federal aid to impacted areas. And those were the areas which had a significant number of children in their enrollments who were dependents of military and civilian personnel of activities in that area. And the philosophy being that military personnel, not being taxpayers of the area, they were creating a burden on the state school systems, and this is the way the federal government was attempting to ease that burden by making revenues available. But in addition, it also required that all schools on the federal establishment be operated by the United States Office of Education. So that cut the funding off from Buord, and then put us under funding from the United States Office of Education. And it was the intent that there be no local school operations within continental U.S. on the military property or federal property, but that the children there go to the local school system, and that the government was going to pay the local school system for accepting. Now that caused a fight. The feeling here on the station was that, and if you'll excuse the expression, that King George had a stinking school system, and they weren't about to send their children to such a system. Therefore, the station was arguing for a high school and elementary school to be operated on station. And the United States Office of Education was saying that's ridiculous, and the county of King George was sitting back saying nothing. And they wound up by compromising to continue the operation of the elementary school as a federal school, and the high school students go to King George with special funding under this bill. That created a problem for a while, and that's understandable also, because our children here on the station had been led to believe that King George County was a stinking system, and that we had a good system, and they didn't appreciate the fact of having to go out of here, and as a result, they went up there with the chip-on-the-shoulder attitude that we come from a superior school system. Mm-hmm. And I suppose some of that is still carrying over today, but I don't think as significantly as it did then. But, as I say, time changes things. This was the best break, I think, that ever came about in bringing the two communities together, was the consolidation of the school system. And it takes the kids to do it.
Did you go to the county schools?
No, I didn't. When I grew up here on the station, we had a high school, but it was neither accredited nor certified, and therefore you were not considered an eligible graduate for admission to college. So I did what, matter of fact, I think I was the first one to make this type of a break. And my folks sent me up to Arlington County, where I lived with my aunt, my mother's sister, and went to Washington Lee High School up in Arlington County. And the following year, virtually everyone in my class went to another school. Some of them went to King George, you know, by moving out and living with somebody. Mm-hmm. Some went down in Montrose, in Warsaw. A very good friend of mine went with me and also lived with my aunt and went to Washington Lee. We both graduated that year. Mm-hmm. But that was the prevailing practice. Some went to Washington, D.C., and went to the high school in Washington, D.C. And that continued until some arrangements were made to be able to go directly from the station to King George High School without the necessity of moving out into the county.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other unique situations that you can remember besides the school?
When I first came here, we had some problems of expansion problems of both programs and otherwise that caused opposition officially in the area. And I was the one who felt that it was because the local people and the state people didn't know what we were doing and didn't have an appreciation for what we were doing and an understanding, and that we couldn't live in that little world of our own, and therefore we had to work with them. So I started a program of getting first the Board of Supervisors of King George County. Let's get them acquainted, not only who we are, but what we're doing. And one thing led to another. And I attended the board meetings, and I served as a command representative on matters of mutual interest between this command and King George County. Then eventually, our personnel themselves became citizens, and they became involved in local government, serving on school boards and on the Board of Supervisors and so forth, so that that became that gradual transformation where it became automatic as opposed to a scheduled activity of working together. Mm-hmm. And so then I tried to concentrate my efforts more down in the Richmond area and to bring this command in closer contact with the governor's office and other departments and agencies. And then, in my capacity of being in an advisory service, for example, Social Security. So, I used to work with those two organizations. That leads you to others. And then, in the 1960s, it became evident that something had to be done to create some housing development in the county. That's when I got involved with what today is known as Bayberry Estates. And at times, I sometimes think I'd like to forget about it all, but it was one tremendous mess is what it wound up being. But now, of course, things look very promising and hopeful for the development of a very nice community every time. But it was government needed, and it was government backed. The government wasn't putting up any money, but the government was insuring loans. And I think it induced just about every rascal you can think of that professed to be a contractor to come down here, because they all had the idea that they were going to get rich overnight mm-hmm. out of this program. And it got to the point where you couldn't believe anybody on anything that they said. And that program floundered and floundered. But eventually it did get off its feet. And as I say, today it seems to be a going housing development. Not exactly as we had hoped and anticipated for. But certainly I think it has still a great deal of potential. And then other developments started up in the county. But when we first got into it, we could not induce any local interest from the governmental standpoint of the county. And we had to work primarily with Richmond and basically with the federal housing officials. And I think I got to know everybody in the Federal Housing Administration during that period of time.
Obtaining proper facilities at Dahlgren has always been a problem. Have you been involved in the various military construction dilemmas over the years?
No, I've been involved in some. We have a much more sophisticated and better qualified, better organized public works department today than we've had heretofore. And so therefore, public works is well staffed to take care of these problems. But we go back to the days of the K-Lab, or the computer lab, mm-hmm. and we had the appropriation approved, or the program approved, by the Department of Defense. And for some reason or another, when the appropriation bill came up in the House of Representatives, the certain elements in there said we had too many computer facilities that were duplicating effort throughout the nation. And they just wiped it out. And it was reported, I'll never forget this, it happened that particular morning, we were painting the interior of our house. I was living at Potomac Beach. Well, because the painters were there, everything was a mess. My wife and I went down to the diner at Colonial Beach to eat our breakfast. And I grabbed the tape and took it, and I was sitting there waiting for my breakfast. I looked and I saw this article in the paper about our laboratory having been knocked out of the appropriation bill. And that was the first information that I'd had about it. And so I immediately got on the phone, and I called Russ LaDain. And I said, and told him what I'd read, and he didn't know anything about it. And I asked him if he could get Captain Sellers. He said, well, Captain Sellers is on a golf course. I said, well, Russ, I'll be back home in about 20 minutes. So Russ went out on the golf course, and he found Captain Sellers, and I got home about 20 minutes, and I had no sooner gotten the house than the phone rang, and Captain Sellers was in his office. And to say he was upset is putting it mildly. He had not been informed by anybody in Washington of this action, and he didn't know, nobody knew it until I told him, and I had read it. It was just a little tiny article in buried in the Richmond Times-Dispatch. So we went to work. And that's where I contacted various and sundry officials and told them what had happened and what it meant. And to make a long story short, the appropriation was reinstated and was approved. And we got the KLAB. So we have always tried to make a point of not influencing anybody, but at least to inform or see that proper sources have information of what we're seeking and the need for it. Because the restoration of that bill was primarily through the efforts of two people in Congress, Willis Robertson, who was then our United States Senator, and Howard Smith, who was our representative. And Willis Robertson never once, and I saw the correspondence on this, asked anybody to do anything because it was in Virginia and these were his constituents. But he based it primarily on the fact that he wrote to John Stennis, Senator Stennis. And he said, you and I were recently on a trip down such and such a place in Florida, and we were on such and such a submarine, and it was there that they were working on this Polaris. And he said, the programming for this is at the Naval Weapons Laboratory at Dalvin. And that's the reason they need this facility. And you and I know that what this means to our defense effort. Mm-hmm. And that was the basis upon which they got it. So we have tried to keep certain sources informed of the technical aspects of programming or other programs for which we need specialized facilities, as opposed to the any aspect of political influence or what it means to the economy of the local area and all that. And I think thus far we've been fairly successful.
Can you recall any specific individuals, either military or civilian, that you consider produced major effects on either the laboratory or the community during their tours here?
Well, I don't think it's any question, but in my mind, the first name that comes to mind is Admiral Joy. Admiral Joy, I think, was one of the finest men personally that I've ever seen here as a commanding officer, and I'm not derogating from others either. Mm-hmm. But he had a special talent, and to me, his special talent was organization. He understood it, he knew it, and he practiced it. He was great for delegating authority, and he got jobs done. He wasn't interested in the petty stuff unless he got a complaint about somebody not doing a job. And he would call them in and say, we got you in that job because you're supposed to be able to do it. If you can't, you say so, and I'll get somebody else. And if you don't produce, I will have you removed and have somebody else that will produce. And that was it. And then as simple as that. And he was a fine man personally. He was an excellent, outstanding golfer. And he was the one that said, I'm going to have a golf course here. And he's the one that built the present golf course.
Is that right?
Yes. All this area over here was marshland. And he said, it's messy looking anyway. And I'm going to clean that up. And I'm going to make that a part of the golf course. And he did. Then he was followed by Admiral Kitts. Admiral Kitts was a fighter up in Washington. And, of course, he was able to do so. He had his promotion to admiral. And so he wasn't afraid of going up there and speaking his piece and stepping on somebody's toes. And Admiral Kitts was the one that was responsible for getting the establishment of the Bank of Dahlgren off the station. And up until that time, we had no banking facilities, either on or off the station, except at King George or at Colonial Beach. And he went up there and he told them, I'm going to have a bank. I don't sit up here and tell me that you're going to stop me. And they wouldn't give him any help, and he came back and he told us, we'll do whatever is necessary within the law, but we're going to get a bank here. And he did. And he got that group of people who are stockholders in the Bank of Westmoreland to create an independent bank off the station and built that building today that is the Bank of Delaware. And then as soon as they got that accomplished, and that was done when it opened while Admiral Duke was here, then the station was able to convert its payroll to check as opposed to cash. But it wasn't up until that time.
People were paid in cash?
Were paid in cash unless they requested a check.
Mm-hmm.
But most people wanted cash. That's the way the station had operated all these years. And again, change. And the people opposed change as a basic rule. But no, our payroll was done by... but we couldn't convert the check because we didn't have the check cashing facilities. We could only do it for those who made a special request for it. But as soon as we got the facilities available within our immediate environment here, the location, we were able to convert that thing to check. I also, myself personally, hold in high esteem the administration of Captain Sellers and Ball. As a team, they made a good working path. They had an outstanding relationship with the employees. They were down to earth. They were wholesome. And they could be serious, and they could be sit down and talk with you on any old subject. And they could be humorous. I found from the working relationship that as a team, they probably stood out. Now, I can't speak for that working relationship from the technical standpoint because I'm not involved and never have been involved in the technical operations of this command. And there may be technical personnel who would take exception to that, and that would be understandable. But I'm looking at it strictly from just the day-to-day routine of working with them as the commanding officer and the deputy commanding officer. Sellers and Ball did, I think, have an excellent relationship with their employees.
Your entire career has been a Dahlgren. Do you have any regrets about not moving elsewhere, perhaps for better job opportunities?
No. I think any of us could leave this area if we wanted to and get higher grades and higher pay. But to me, it isn't worth it. I realize that I'm obviously biased in my evaluation area, having grown up here. But I wouldn't trade living in this area of rural Virginia for all the tea in China by living up in Washington or whatnot. I went to school up there. And when I went to school in Arlington County, it was rural, believe it or not. Rural enough to the extent that I could ride a bicycle 3 miles to get to school without any fear of heavy traffic. But you wouldn't dare undertake to do such a thing today. I used to ride a bicycle in the District of Columbia on any occasion without any fear whatsoever. The traffic, we might say, was heavy for those times, but it wasn't a fast-moving traffic. And it was no problem at all in providing transportation via a bicycle. And I spent a lot of time over at the Capitol, over at the Library of Congress, in the House Office Building, in the Senate Office Building, just browsing around, meeting people, talking with them. And I've been that kind, I suppose, all my life. I like to talk to people. And if I don't know them, I don't mind introducing myself just for the sake of discussing, of a discussion. But insofar as living up there now, or in any other metropolitan area, I personally don't want any part of it. And I feel that this laboratory is unique in the opportunities that it can offer to young people in the way of career employment and provide them the luxury of living in this area. And I don't think I have to emphasize that point because you go anywhere else and tell people what you do and where you live, and there's immediate envy that it crops up. They would like to have such an opportunity. It took the local school authorities, I will say this without question, some time to recognize the fact that the potential in the technical and professional fields was here to stay at this activity, and that their educational processes were going to have to be geared to it. And I'm not suggesting that they've accomplished it yet, but certainly they are. It's a far cry today as to what it used to be. I don't think there's any question about that.
Are there any plans for retirement?
Oh, yes. I'm going out this year, hopefully. I will retire sometime this year, or certainly by the end of this year. Mm-hmm. And I have no particular plans for retirement. I'm not going to go into private practice. At least I have no intentions of doing it now, but, you know, we can all make plans, and we can just hope that the plans will materialize. We never know what's going to develop. And as I say, my plans are to retire this year, and I do not have plans set up in practice. I'm not going to suggest that I wouldn't do some practice if something came to me that I might be interested in, but I'm not going to. My thinking now is not to open up an office and hold myself out for practice. I have a number of projects of my own that are personal that I will attempt to do, and I hope to do some traveling. And the thing that I look forward to, insofar as any travel is concerned, and I'm not talking about traveling the world, personally, I have no desire to go abroad. I've never seen the United States, really. And plenty of areas around in the United States that I would like to see first. But the thing that I do look forward to is the fact that I can go when I want to and I can come back when I want to, hopefully, if I'm retired. And won't have to be geared to a work schedule that I have to get back on such and such a date. I don't mind the commuting, and I live at Montrose, and that's 35 miles distance, or 70 mile round trip a day, and that has never bothered me, and I've commuted. When I was married, we moved on the station, and I lived in Boomtown, and we moved in 1952 to Potomac Beach, we built our home there, and then I moved from there in 66 to Montrose. So I have spent the most of my time commuting, and I don't regret that a bit. You make some close friendships in commuting. You have some interesting experiences. You have to get up early. I have to get up at 5:30 every morning, but I don't. You get used to that, and in the final analysis, I don't know if that isn't better for you. I will argue with myself on that point when I'm getting up at 5:30. But you always say you never get enough sleep. And I dare say that when I retire, it's going to be a long time before I get out of the habit of arising at 5:30. I may not get up, but I guarantee you I'll be waking up. But I don't have any real significant plans of anything. I'm just playing by ear and do, I hope, what comes naturally. And I just hope that I will be able to retire and to enjoy it for a while. And that's one of the main reasons I want to retire. I tell you, I've been thinking about it for some time, and then last December, Bob Talley died. Mm-hmm. Well, now Bob Talley and Rudy Lowry and I were real close up on it. And then Rudy died, and I think if I had any questions in my mind about retiring, I think the fact that these two boys had untimely deaths certainly made my mind up for me, definitely. And I said, well, neither one of them got the opportunity to retire. Now, Rudy wasn't eligible to retire quite yet. Bob was. But he had an untimely death, and so did Rudy. And I thought about it. I don't think I had him. I was particularly close to Rudy. And the thing makes you think. Matter of fact, I gave very serious consideration going out pretty right after he died. But I mean, the good Lord is going to tell me when time comes anyway, so I don't think it's going to make that much difference. But I don't know what he has in mind for me. I'm going to try to get in some free time on my own, do a few things I'd like to do. I rather suspect that even though I retire, that I will be in fairly close contact with the station through telephone, because you can't be here. I haven't been here any inordinate length of time. I came here in 1949, so I had 5 years military service, so that gives me 27 years of civilian service, or a total of 32 years. Actually, I have 32 years and 7 months at the end of the year. But you can't be here all that time and absorb, or document, rather, what has taken place and things that you've been involved in. And there's so many little things that come up that I get referred to me primarily because of the fact that I've been here as long as I have, and also because of the fact that I lived here on the station, grew up here on the station. And names mean something to me, and policies and conditions and so forth and so on. I get calls several times a week from different department heads, do you remember so-and-so, or do you remember such-and-such an event? And what did we do then, and how was it handled? So I'm confident I'm going to get those calls bound to. And it'll go on for a while, and then it'll gradually taper off. But I assume that when I first retire that I may get right many calls on problems of local nature that are peculiar, perhaps, to my memory. Lawrence Jones, of course, grew up on this station. Also went to school here. And he and I get together quite frequently on the phone, comparing notes. And we don't always agree on our recollections. And when you called concerning Mr. Riffault, it was rather amazing. We all had a general recollection, but we could not specifically say as a fact anything.
Thank you for listening to this week's Dahlgren Centennial podcast. And hopefully you have learned another interesting aspect of what our people accomplished for the Navy and for our nation. We will continue sharing how Dahlgren is one-of-a-kind location where innovation is heralded as the hallmark of each individual. Tune in next week to hear from Dr. Thomas A. Clare. Dr. Clare was a technical director at Dahlgren from 1989 to 1998. He is perhaps best known for his role in Aegis development at Dahlgren. Thank you for celebrating this century of innovation with us at Dahlgren.